Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It is time for today's look at the 2022 Human Rights Watch Film Festival, back in person this year and streaming online. And we'll turn now to a documentary about the climate activism group Extinction Rebellion, which was founded in the UK in April 2018. The group led two massive week-long demonstrations in the streets of London in 2019, demanding that the government officially declare a climate emergency. One happened in April and one in October. All told, more than 2,000 people were arrested as part of these protests. That was largely by design. Getting arrested is one of the group's tactics to bring a sense of urgency to the decades-long slow roll of climate crisis. So it's what they call nonviolent direct action, breaking the law loudly and publicly without engaging with the police when they inevitably come to put a stop to this illegal action. Here's a little bit of what that sounds like. This is, I think, Extinction Rebellion co-founder Gail Bradbrook giving instructions through a megaphone as the police arrive to break up a demonstration. It's a little hard to hear, but she starts with, "Take a deep breath."
Stop. Stand still. Take a breath. You don't need to resist arrest. If you don't want to be arrested, stand back. If you're happy to be arrested, go easily. We're a non-violent movement.
The documentary Rebellion takes us inside the protests and the movement. We see what this looks like, including the internal rifts within Extinction Rebellion, discussion about how much disruption is too much and who gets to make that decision, who has a deciding voice. Those rifts are most strongly illustrated in the relationship between Roger Hallam, a founding member of XR, and his daughter Savannah, who's committed to the cause but struggles with burnout, and her father's unyielding belief system. Joining us now to talk about their documentary Rebellion, which is featured as one of the films of the 2022 Human Rights Watch Film Festival, please welcome documentary filmmakers Maya Kenworthy. Hi, Maya.
Hi, hello there.
And Elena Sanchez. Elena, nice to meet you.
Hi, thank you for that meditation. I enjoyed it a lot.
Sometimes we just need it with the world these days. Just need a minute.
Definitely called me before this interview. That was great.
Maya, when did Extinction Rebellion come onto your radar?
It came onto our radar a few days before we then started filming the group. It all happened very, very quickly. So it was at the end of 2018. A friend of ours had made a film on Occupy, and some of the activists from Occupy, unsurprisingly, were joining this new group. And so she'd been introduced to the co-founders, and she kind of did a call out, and we went along to meet them as well. And so we went to that first press conference that you see in the film back in 2018. And we just were, you know, we were very new. We'd not been involved in an activist group before. And I guess we didn't really know what to expect, but quite quickly we realized that those sort of stereotypes around activism were not really holding up, and that there were all kinds of people joining and people who were completely new to it themselves as well, and were just willing to give civil disobedience a go and step up their commitment in a really big way. And so we thought, okay, well, these guys are serious about this, and let's stick around and see what happens.
Part of the way we take this journey is by getting to know the people involved. Elena, who was Roger Hallam before he helped start Extinction Rebellion? What was he doing?
I mean, Roger is an organic farmer in Wales, and he was doing that for, I think, about 15 years or something like that. But then, and you know, his crops were completely decimated a few years in a row because of unpredictable weather patterns. And then on the side, he was also doing a PhD on radical campaign design. So Extinction Rebellion was kind of like him, you know, it was one of his attempts at putting what he was studying into practice and trying to get radical campaign design into British, modern British politics and activism.
So that's Roger's story. And then we also meet Farhana, who joins Extinction Rebellion's radical approach. But after decades of UN presentations, and she's a lawyer, and she really hasn't gotten the results that they know they need. Maya, what did she bring to the conversation that you found interesting?
Yeah, I think firstly, she wasn't what we expected in the group once. Yeah, I mean, someone who's been on the inside, as it were, you know, trying to change things through these negotiations that, you know, and there had been progress, there had been countries coming together and agreeing to things. But yeah, we learned through her story that basically it's very frustrating, all of that, because while things are agreed at the conference, politicians then go home and they end up listening to the fossil fuel lobbyists, and that those agreements are not, you know, adhered to, things don't actually shift. And so I think that that frustration and that, you know, seeing how, you know, that process wasn't working, really, really wasn't working from someone who's given it everything. I mean, she really has been at the heart of it. She's been a lead author on IPCC reports. She was very much behind the Paris Agreement. Like, she's right at the heart of it. So for someone like that to say, actually, this isn't enough, this isn't working, that was very powerful and really made, you know, the case for direct action for civil disobedience feel very strong, very needed. And of course, she was bringing this global perspective. She's represented people who are on the front lines of this crisis right now, have been for decades. She's worked with the Marshall Islands, you know, the small island nation states, which are, you know, having a really dreadful time with rising sea levels. Mm-hmm. They're losing their homes. And I think it's just really important to be reminded of that. You know, I think it's increasingly hard to ignore what's going on, to say that the climate crisis isn't really a big deal. Clearly we can see that it is, but I think when you actually hear more directly those stories and you know remember the impact it's really having on people's lives, that makes you, you know, not want to ever turn away and to really devote time to this and bring more people on board.
Elena, though, in the beginning, Farhana, she's operated a certain way, and you can see that she's got some discomfort with trying to figure out, what is this group about? How can I operate and be my authentic self within this group? How did you observe the way she was trying to figure out her place and how she really felt about Extinction Rebellion's tactics?
I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we really respected so much about Farhana and other people in XR was that they could see a lot of things that they didn't agree with, and they still kind of rolled up their sleeves and were like, okay, this is what's missing here. I can see these really good things and then these other things that are missing, and I'm going to roll up my sleeves and give it a go and try to improve it. And, you know, I really respect that, because I think very often it's really easy to stand on the sidelines and point fingers. You know, and Farhana was kind of getting it from all sides, because she was getting it from her more conservative or liberal friends, like, you know, what are you doing with these radicals? And then she was getting it from like all of her lefty friends, because they're like, what are you doing with this group that has like, you know, no kind of like political analysis of power and capitalism and race and all these things. And so I really kind of felt for her, stuck in between those things. And then on top of that, yeah, trying to figure out her own place in the movement and, you know, ways of working that she wasn't used to. And, you know, she gave it a go and just was really committed and brought a lot to the movement and learned a lot from the movement. And, you know, it was both ways.
Yeah, it's just interesting to the give and take and the push and the pull from people who want to work outside the system to people who want to work within the system to try to help the climate crisis. And then there's a whole other silo of thinking, people who want to bring in racial and socioeconomic justice to be part of this work and saying, like, how can you even divorce it from that? You can't. But, you know, it's an interesting set of priorities. Everybody's got the same priority, but then different ways to sort of uphold that priority. Let's listen to a little bit of an activist from the film Rebellion named Alejandra.
We cannot talk about the climate crisis without talking about justice. Typical white Western environmentalism, they only usually like think about emissions, that the only issue is climate change. Why are we wasting any time talking about racism or colonialism? If you think about making the green transition, right, to renewable energies, where do you think the minerals for the electric car batteries come from? Where do you think that lithium comes from? Where do you think all the metals for turbines come from? All of that is still heavily reliant on extractivism. We're displacing whole communities. There's kids in mines as young as 5 getting cobalt so that we can have that solar panel. That's the world that we live in right now. And I don't want to simply have the same world, but eco.
That is from the film Rebellion. I'm speaking with its directors, Elena Sanchez and Maya Kenworthy. How did that conversation play out within Extinction Rebellion?
I think it had been there from the beginning, you know, that there are often, I think, perceptions of a group like this, that they are this homogenous group and they think this way and they're a bunch of hippies or whatever. But actually, we found that there were lots of different viewpoints within, and that call for justice was there. Someone like Farhana absolutely brought that and would talk about it. And, you know, Extinction Rebellion's three demands, one of them was about carbon emissions, getting to net zero by 2025. And she from the beginning said, guys, where's the human rights angle here? You know, it's not just about emissions. But I think really it was the youth that brought it to the forefront in a very powerful way about a year into our filming. And we happened to be there when they confronted some of the co-founders about the way that they were doing things. And so we kind of wanted to follow their story and let them tell it for us. And they speak so passionately. And, you know, as you hear Alejandra speaking there, she just lays it out so simply for us. You know, it's very compelling. You sort of, I don't think anyone can disagree with what she's saying, really. So yeah, we thought they were the best voices to tell it.
You know, at one point when you're interviewing Roger, one of the co-founders of Extinction Rebellion, he sort of chastises y'all for using the phrase climate change, which he calls, quote, corporate framing. Elena, what is his issue with climate change as a phrase?
I mean, Roger just likes to be contrarian, and also he's very funny, and so that's also him just being funny. I think that, you know, I mean, the wording has moved on from, you know, climate change to the climate crisis, because it is a climate crisis or a climate emergency. So I think that's kind of what he's alluding to, and I think it's just like, you know, he's so aware of this becoming a talking point that, you know, politicians can just archive in their drawer once they've given you 5 minutes of airtime, and then that's it. And he's just really aware of that and doesn't want to give anyone an opportunity to get away with it and just, yeah, use it as a talking point without any action.
My guests are Elena Sanchez and Maya Kenworthy. We're talking about their film Rebellion. It's part of the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. In terms of the climate crisis, I want to ask you about what's going on in the UK, because the activism is targeted towards UK politics, Maya. What do the institutional politics of climate policy look like in the UK?
It's not looking great at the moment. Unfortunately, our government has used the war in Ukraine as an excuse to allow more drilling to take place. So that they're saying, yeah, new oil licenses are going to be fine. We can do that, even though they have actually admitted themselves that it's not going to solve our cost of living crisis. You know, because it takes such a long time for that oil actually to be in a state where people can use it. Also, we export a lot of that oil. It just doesn't add up at all. And of course, yeah, we've got this climate emergency. Like, what are we doing agreeing to more oil sites? It's going to blow our 2050 goal, which is already too late, but it's going to totally blow that out of the water. So people are feeling really quite frustrated that the government's not tackling the climate crisis or the cost of living crisis. And that's why we have in recent months seen activists like Extinction Rebellion taking to the streets again, and also blocking oil refinery sites themselves, you know, really sending that message loud and clear that we have to stop oil, stop new oil. It's just not the way to go, and we shouldn't be carrying on down that path, you know. So people still resolved to keep acting, because we have to, unfortunately.
People know about Extinction Rebellion now, but when you think back to April 2019, before the April Rebellion, what did the groups sort of look like, let's say March 2019, and how did that week of protests change it? You want to take that, Elena?
Yeah, I mean, we were just asked about this recently, actually, and I was saying that, yeah, you see it in the film as well, the meetings just before the April Rebellion. Roger is saying, you know, well, if it's 300 of us, it'll be a 300 show. And you can see those meetings, they're, you know, like 7-8 people in a meeting, and then, you know, the bigger groups are maybe, you know, 30 to 40. So it was, you know, it was a real grassroots effort of going around so many town halls in the UK and like giving all these talks and getting people interested and, you know, kind of convincing them to come to London. But, you know, neither they nor us knew what was actually going to happen on that day in April. And then suddenly thousands of people were there and central London was blocked, and it just kind of blew everyone away. And then I think, you know, on the one side, that was incredible. And then obviously the climate emergency was declared. And then on the other hand, you know, you have all the issues with suddenly, you know, this movement that was comprised of a few hundred people and suddenly has, you know, thousands. And how do you deal with that influx of people? How do you deal with the influx of ideas? And you know, you need a lot of systems in place for that to work. And, you know, it was a learning process.
Maya, we see Roger sort of psyched about the number of arrests that come out each day of the week of the protest. Why is he so excited about that metric?
Because it means that there's a lot of disruption happening. And when you cause disruption in a capital city, often you're going to get a lot of media attention, and then you're going to get the politicians taking note, and you get the public talking about it, especially, you know, the disruption itself is often affecting members of the public. So it's getting those conversations going. It's changing public consciousness. You know, it's getting through to people. And also, you know, it's that he feels very strongly that, you know, actions speak louder than words. And so if people are putting their bodies on the line, if they're taking these risks, you know, other people are gonna, you know, even if they don't wanna join them, they might take note, they might respect, they might see, okay, yeah, clearly things are bad if you're willing to do this. So yeah, he sees that as the most effective strategy. And as Lena said, yeah, it did have a big impact, has been having a big impact. And you can see why after many, you know, many years of the UN process, of people doing marches and petitions and et cetera, and we're still on the same path, I can, you know, totally understand why that disruption tactic is the one that people are now turning to. You know, it's the last resort, really.
Yeah, and I think it's also about, like, you know, putting governments in a bit of a dilemma situation. It's like what Roger says in the film. It's like they either let you stay on the streets and then there's mass disruption and also economic loss, or they arrest you, which they also don't want to do because that's also costs so much money and is really disruptive. So then they have to sit down and you know, have a meeting with you and negotiate. And that's kind of, you know, they're trying to force the government to act because governments know what they have to do. They're just not doing it.
Maya, you do carry a scene in the film, though, of people who are, you know, the disruption is disrupting their lives. They've worked hard. They want to go home. They want to be on their subway. And it gets violent in a moment with one of the protesters because people are like, I need to get on this train. I want to go home. Stop stopping me from going home. How did Extinction Rebellion deal with that dilemma while you were covering them, that they wanted to have these, you know, sort of radical tactics, but they did run the risk of alienating people?
Yeah, it's very difficult. And we could see that from the beginning, going along to these nonviolent direct action training workshops. They would role play these situations to prepare people who were new to this tactic, you know, for what it was going to be like, that you are going to face anger, totally understandably, from people. And how do you deal with that? And yeah, it's something they really struggle with because no one wants to be doing that to other people. You know, ultimately they're there in the first place because they care about other people, because they don't want us to be on this awful path we're on. So that is a constant struggle, I think, for activists, of sitting with that. They did make sure that, you know, they always get out of the way for ambulances. There's no need for them to continue to block if there's an emergency like that. So they're very conscious of that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, throughout history, civil disobedience, it's not popular. That's, you know, that's how it is. And we can look back on some of those movements and now celebrate them. But at the time, they weren't popular. And that's just kind of the deal with doing this. So it's just, I think, having to accept that. There are obviously some targets, some places that maybe, you know, are not so wise to disrupt. And in the film, that the area that they're targeting is a working class area. And I think, you know, it was also a very small action that wasn't happening elsewhere. So it, I think those people felt particularly frustrated. And that wasn't actually a central team decision. That was a few activists deciding to do that. And a lot of people in the movement said, please don't do that. So that, you know, it's also, how do you, it's really a very decentralized movement, actually. And that can cause its own difficulties with, you know, people responding differently. It still was a nonviolent action, but yeah, as you see, it did provoke a particularly strong reaction that was difficult for the group, and it did affect then everyone, because then the media jumped on it, because obviously it's a very dramatic scene, and that's difficult because then the whole movement gets brushed with that. So it's tricky.
Elena, what's the latest on Extinction Rebellion? What are they doing these days?
So they just had a rebellion in April in the UK, and I think in the US, because New York City has an XR group as well, and I think they did one a week later or 2 weeks later. And I think they're kind of just in a stage of recruiting more people and getting more people trained up to do NVDA, nonviolent direct action, to then have a bigger rebellion in September. But also, you know, XR has grown so much, and I think that the local groups that are all around the country and now all around the world are kind of doing really exciting things because they can do things that are relevant to them locally, but then can also be called in to, you know, come in on, to the capital when big actions are happening. And I think that's really clever organizing. They've activated a kind of network, a mycelium of people. And I think Farhana told us recently that if XR was an NGO, it would have a bigger membership base than Greenpeace, for example.
Maya, before I let you go, is there something, what is something that you learned or came to understand more fully when, you know, as opposed to the first day you spent with XR and the last day you spent with XR?
So many things. It's a big journey that we went on, wasn't it, Elena? I think just realizing like this is work that people really are committed to for the long run. And I'm still humbled by that, because although they go into campaign mode and there are big moments of push, you know, they really get together and engage in these direct action tactics. Like a lot of the people we were meeting, they're really committed to this forevermore. I mean, I guess kind of have to be, because this crisis isn't going anywhere. It's just going to get worse, right? But I think that's something that I really have a lot of respect for. I think when we first met them and they were talking about the rebellion in central London, it felt like, okay, well, that's what they're working towards. And that's the big, you know, it was sort of a 6 month plan and that's that. But then we realized, no, they're going to keep going. They're brushing themselves off and carrying on. And it, you know, we're seeing in the UK now with the police are being given more and more powers to clamp down on protests. You know, our government is trying to silence people speaking up about anything, really. And yet they're still continuing. So yeah, that commitment is really inspiring, actually.
The documentary is called Rebellion, from filmmakers Maya Kenworthy and Elena Sanchez. It's part of the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. Maya and Elena, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.